The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Thank you for all coming, and it's good to be here again. I've been right once for this, and it's good to see so many of you out. Can you all hear me, first of all?
Yes.
Because I don't like microphones. I prefer to talk directly. In the communities I work in Vancouver, Canada, in the Native world, before we hold a gathering, we do something called the good words that precede all words. And in the Native tradition, that is to acknowledge and give thanks for each other, and also our ancestors, the one who brought us here, and also the ones who can't be here. And I wanted to acknowledge them before we do anything with these two images that I've got up. This first one is a banner that we've taken all over the world. This was made by children in the Downtown East Side, mostly Aboriginal children, in memory of the children who died in the Indian boarding schools in Canada. And we've held this outside churches and inside churches. We held it several times outside the Vatican in Rome, outside Buckingham Palace, all over the world really, outside the Parliament buildings in Ottawa, Canada. And as part of that work, I began to meet all sorts of different people, including those in the Mohawk Confederacy. And this is a very important symbol. As a matter of fact, the last time I was in Mohawk territory near Montreal, I was given this. It's called the Truro Wampum. And as people in England, it's very important you understand this history, because it's the very first treaty that was ever established between the Mohawk Confederacy and the Crown of England in 1689. You see, when the English and the French first arrived in my part of the world, they needed the native people for military alliances and the fur trade and other things. And so they signed a treaty with them, and it was actually devised by the Mohawk. And this represents the two rivers of life down which the native people go in their canoe and the Europeans come in their ship. And the idea that the symbol in the Rutura Wampum was that the Europeans and the indigenous people were to go side by side down life together, not seeking to dominate one another. And so on the basis of that recognition, this treaty was signed. It was called the Truro Wampum Treaty. And it wasn't only about indigenous people, it was also to establish the way that settlers were to live in the New World, not on the basis of being dominated by anybody, but on the basis of equality. So in effect, it was the first constitution in Canada. Now, the Crown of England abrogated this, and that's why the Mohawks gave this to me and actually authorized me to take this message out to my people, which is to say, we have always stood by the Truro Wampum, but the Europeans haven't. The Europeans violated this when they imposed their false jurisdiction on Canada, when they brought in the Indian Act, when they tried to wipe out the native nations that had trusted them and invited them into their territory. So, a lot of this work for me has become more than what originally brought me into this work almost 20 years ago now. And we can talk a little bit about that later, I hope, because as we often talk about in our circles in Vancouver and other places, wisdom is held in the group, not by an expert. And so I often look to all of you to contribute tonight in order to relate this to our own lives, because, and I'll just end on this, that for me, very much now, the issue has to do with certain basic things that we all share, the survival and the safety of our children in the face of organized child trafficking and a whole history of assaults on children, which did not just happen in the boarding schools, but which unfortunately is a legacy of not just European traditions, but certainly of Christendom in the New World and in other countries around the world, and how those abuses and crimes continue to the day, and the survival of all of us on this planet together. So one of the things I've learned is that there's all sorts of narratives or stories in any one issue, and we hope to bring that out tonight. The main way I hope to bring it out is through this film, and this film was made almost 4 years ago now. And it was done on the basis of an experience I had bringing out these stories as I worked with Native people as a Protestant clergyman on the west coast of Canada. And the way we devised the film was to tell two stories, the story of a white minister and the story of people he was meeting, to put a human face on this whole thing we call genocide. And I'll be happy to share more of that after, but the way we thought we'd do it tonight, because the film was 2 hours long and we wouldn't have time for discussion, we're going to have a natural break in the film at 40 minutes, and after those 40 minutes, we're going to open up for your comments and discussion, questions and everything. And we have copies of the film, we have copies of my books, and the other work that we're doing here in England and around the world, so we can be you know, sharing all of that after. So that's going to be the format, and I think I'll just stop there and we'll just watch the film, which actually tells you more than I can right now. And after 40 minutes, then we'll open it up for all of you. Thank you. Comments or questions?
Yep. I'd like to go to Perth, Australia, and it's, you know, so I'm not that shocked because I've gone and had the Aborigines out there live now and how they've been destroyed. And I knew about smallpox. Is this any different? Is it worse than what happened in Australia? I mean, I'm sure you've looked at the Australian case. Is it what the comparison is?
It's kind of hard to talk in terms of worse or better because it's all the same beast, you know. Strategies are different. I think Australia, South Africa, Canada are really similar. They're kind of like settler societies where this kind of colonial arrangement really hasn't ever changed. But I know that I met a delegation of Aboriginal people from Australia, and they were telling me stories that like were identical to what you hear in the residential schools. Canada. So no, I don't think it was really that different. The thing about Canada that you get, and that this is one of the problems in getting this story out, is that the perception people have in the world of Canada is that this is wonderful, probably because of the contrast with America. And there's other people from Vancouver here too who can probably come in on this. But you know, the whole idea that was propagated by the Crown is that under the protection of the Crown, Indians have it better. You know, they fled Custer and came up, and the Great White Mother Victoria protected her infant Indians, you know, kind of like that attitude. The reality is very different. The area where I live on Vancouver Island, and this has now been documented in some books, the Royal Navy used to go up and down in the 1860s when the white settlers were first coming in. The Royal Navy made a practice of bombarding all the Cowichan villages, just shelling them, destroying them. There was and in my latest edition of Hidden from History, we document how there was an Anglican missionary called John Sheepshanks. And he went on to he was appointed Bishop of Norwich and ended up in the House of Lords until 1908. What Sheepshanks did is he went into the northern interior of British Columbia and he inoculated a lot of the Chilcotin Indians with smallpox. Within about 2 to 3 months, 80% of them were dead. He was a partner in what's called the Puget Sound Land Company, owned by the Hudson's Bay, and all the government ministers and chief judge, they were all shareholders in this company. They had preempted the land. In Canada, what you did, like in Australia, you go and build a fence or a tent anywhere, and it's yours. You preempt it, so you take it from the Indians that week. But you're not allowed to do that if there's living Indians on the land. Well, they were preempting this land before any of them died, knowing they were going to die off en masse, and then who gets all the land? Well, all the shareholders. And so that process was actually led by the missionaries. And, you know, I tell audiences in Canada about this, and they go, well, no, that's the Anglican Church. I mean, I've gone there since I was a kid. They wouldn't have killed off people deliberately, right? But, and what what we need to look at is the fact that European civilization is both, like any culture. It's the light and the darkness. Okay, yeah, it's people wanting to do good in their interpretation of what good is, but it's also this other side which we can't look at as the people who did it. It's very. My wife Carol taught in Japan for 6 years, and she tried to talk to them about what Japan did in China during the 1930s, Nanking, Manchuria, all that. Not taught in history books. It's as void in the history books as this is in Canada. And you got to go outside of your capital culture to often learn these things. But I mean, it's the same thing we're dealing with. You know.
Yep. How up to date is the Indian Act? That part of the Indian Act that was read out, is that up to date now?
Yeah, the latest revision was in 1986, but it hasn't been revised since then. And all of those provisions are still in place if you live on reserve in Canada. So it's kind of a Native people are kind of blackmailed. If you want to get government assistance, you stay on reserve. Basically, you're living on a concentration camp. And if you live off reserve, which is what a lot of people do, you don't have access to a lot of the government funding in that. And as others can comment, it's the people I work with in Vancouver are dying. I mean, you know, they did a study, the Globe and Mail newspaper, they just ranked Indians as a nation in Canada back in 1999. And they were 58 in the world, below Brazil and Thailand. Just right across the board, infant mortality, sickness. I mean, tuberculosis, the people I work with die from tuberculosis from all the crack pipes. AIDS is increasing quicker in the native community than any group in Canada. It's like all of those statistics. So it's like when all these Aboriginal women go missing and nothing's ever done about it, the attitude of cops is literally, they're Indians, who cares?
How can the Canadian people, as a so-called civilized society, how can they live with this act in place?
That's the old question. How many people know about it? It's not taught in schools. You don't learn about it anymore. The minute you start talking in these terms, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I just want to say, I'm sharing the other person from Vancouver. when I went to high school, you learn about obviously the history of Canada and stuff like that from social studies. And you learn about the relations between Europe and the humans of Canada and the Aboriginal people, but it's always, when they talk about the smallpox epidemic that broke out, it's presented like that it was, you know, accidental, obviously. The Europeans brought the disease, and the native people there obviously didn't have immunity to it, so of course they died off, and it's kind of presented in that way. And I had no idea until I spoke to Kevin earlier, and he was actually telling me about it. In terms of why the Canadian people don't really, like, how, you know, we can live with it, it's the fact that, you know, as he was saying, if they move off the reserves, they lose a lot of the government benefits that they're offered. Like, for example, Native youth, for example, are basically offered free university education. If they can get into university, they will pay for education. The fact of the matter is, not that many Native youth go to university because they don't get in. They're raised, you know, there's a lot of drug use, alcoholism, that kind of thing is happening on the reserves. And, you know, the government doesn't really make an effort to improve the sort of living social conditions on the reserves. They just get to university in the first place, that kind of thing. There's a lot of segregation, like he was saying, in his community, it's the same kind of thing all over BC. There was one Native student at my high school, when I was school, and he only attended for 1 year. They kind of keep to themselves, but it's just that there's no integration. So if you don't really know Native people, how are you really going to be aware of these issues? You know, I mean, they have to struggle so much to really get their voices heard. And often that's, you know, by them going to the media and doing protests and campaigning. But honestly, like, the most experience I have with Native people personally is when they're on the streets trying to sell carvings or begging, that kind of thing. Like, you just don't really have that inspiration.
Yep. How is the residential schools where the kids forced to go there? Kevin, or was there a choice for families to?
No, well, first of all, Indians were not citizens, so they didn't have the right to say no. Between 1929 and 53, it was against the law for a Native person to hire a lawyer, and you would be disbarred if your white lawyer took on a Native client. But nevertheless, they brought in a law in 1920, federal law, that made it mandatory for every Native child over 7 to be in one of these camps they called schools. Now, if you didn't go, your parents would go to jail. But some of the people in the film here were hidden by their parents and moved around, and the reason they're going to talk about this stuff now is they didn't go through that traumatization. Like, the day you arrive at a residential school, you're lined up on the beach, in the case of Port Alberni, your heads are all shaved, you have DDT powder put on you. The boys and girls are separated, they're never allowed to speak. That's Raphael Lemkin's key definition of a cultural genocide. You're destroying normal relations, so that in the long run, what's going to happen, right? Dysfunctional, self-destructive families, okay? Mandatory rape of every child coming to the school. That was the norm. We found that out in a lawsuit that happened, where the United Church was forced by a court order to disclose this book they had, which acknowledged that children were to be raped upon arrival in school.
Was that raped by clerics? I mean, by
staff. Clerics and staff. It was just with the procedure.
Okay. That's written down?
Yeah, it was in a punishment book. Now, what happened was interesting in that case because it was referred to by one of the lawyers. There was a media ban put on the reporting of the case, And then that vanished from the media. And you won't find that reference anymore, just like a lot of this material I found in the libraries and all be taken out. The Indian hospitals where they were doing the sterilization program, and later in the film, and you can have, there's copies of the film here you can have and duplicate. The sterilization laws that were brought in against, aimed at Native people. The National Archives had a lot of the records of the Indian hospitals until 1999, and then they all got officially sealed. So you can't get in there anymore without security clearance. So Canada is very good at presenting a face that, yeah, we're doing this healing and reconciliation now, but at the same time, they're burying all the records. So how can you prove a lot of these things except through the eyewitnesses? And 1 in 1,000 are going to be able to talk about this. And then when they do talk about it, the impact is terrible in the community. Like, people are ostracized, suicide very often when people start talking.
So here's the case of William Cook, who's been talking about.
Yeah, we're into there. Yeah. It's just a constant uphill battle to get any of this up. But what I'll tell you what broke the ice with this, after the film came out, there was a Native member of Parliament called Gary Marasky, and he saw the film. And in April 2007, he gets up in Parliament, and he says, when are we going to bring these children home for proper burial? And then boom, I mean, it's on the parliamentary record. You know, they can't ignore it anymore. So the Globe and Mail starts reporting this stuff that we've been talking about for 10 years, and suddenly Canadians go, oh. But interestingly enough, that was down the memory hole again in about a month. It was just very... Canada did an official apology in June of 2008, where they made no reference to the churches. It's like they're talking about the Crown without any criminals, you know. The churches and government, like in Ireland, they got together before any of the lawsuits and they legally indemnified themselves. So they said, we will grant compensation and a public apology in return for every Native person who receives money signs off, not only signs off legal action, but like in Ireland, you indemnify the churches. They say you're not wrong, they're not guilty of anything. And so in effect, it's a way to do what they always do, which is to gag the survivors and protect the perpetrators, which is not surprising because they're in power. I mean, yeah.
I just have a question. The role of the church, why was it in the church's interest to, take these children and use them like that? What I'm asking today, what was in it for the church? What
money.
Were they getting in return?
First of all, money. They were given a lot of money per child to run these schools. Constantly, like back in 1920, they get $113 per year per child. Most of that went into their own pocket. They didn't feed the kids often at all. I mean, I remember Delmar, who's in there describing being put with kids who had TB. He said he used to like to be on the garbage detail because when they're taking out the slops from the nuns and the priests, they'd be eating garbage because otherwise they'd have to break out of the school at night and go hunting for food. I mean, they were starving these kids to death and pocketing all the money. They also built the residential schools on really lucrative land. And that's the issue that got me fired, because I found out that they were situating the residential schools near the main fishing grounds among rare rich timber resources. So the churches were big land speculators. And when you look at the founding document of the United Church of Canada, Parliament sets it up and it gives it the power of a bank. These churches have the power to issue promissory notes and lend money. And I'm thinking, okay, so why are churches set up as banks? Well, they're the first ones into an area. They grab all the land under preemption laws. And then they're land brokers. So, I mean, it's under the guise of religion and education, making a hell of a lot of money, right? But it's also part of the whole culture that, and this happened all over the world, of course, they're savages. They are branded. Go back, and this is why it's very much involving the Queen of England and the Pope, because as far back as 1455, there were papal laws that said non-Christians don't have the right to their own land. The Christian kings have the obligation to conquer these people who are not Christians. It's the two papal bulls. I love that term, by the way. Papal bulls, it says a lot. But it's sanctioned genocide and colonialism all over the world. And there have been attempts to get the Vatican to revoke those laws. It's never happened. But it gave the blessing for everything that happened after it. So you're dealing with an entire culture of legal genocide, and that's why it's hard now to talk in terms of making it better, because it's still in operation. We know, you know, in the downtown CBC, it's like it's open season on Indians. It's still that way. So,
you just mentioned the story that I think is in the film about the Queen visiting. Is that famous?
Yeah.
Is that relevant at this point?
Well, I think it's all relevant.
Yeah, I just think that's really, because you know, this is sort of distant and it's like.
Yeah. Well, there was an account by William Coombs, who was a student. He used to be in my radio program a lot for about 4 years. And William, when he was a kid, he and two other kids saw, they claimed they saw the Queen of England, Prince Philip, show up at the school. This is the Kamloops Catholic Residential School, October 1964. And I checked the Queen's visiting records, and sure enough, they were in Canada for 11 days during that time. But they claimed they were in Eastern Canada. This is out in British Columbia. William says that the Queen showed up and they all went down to the school for the river for picnic, and they left with 10 children, 7 boys and 3 girls, and none of those kids were ever seen again, which was odd because they were all from that area. They were never seen for the rest of their lives. And William was coming to, in September we're doing a tribunal in London, and we're bringing people actually from all over the world, including Ireland, Australia, and we're having, we can talk about that later, but William was to come and speak about that. And we had already written to Buckingham Palace about this, asking if they could confer or deny it, and never heard back. William, in February, suddenly he was in good health, he was actually recovering. I had not seen him so sober ever, because he was a spirit dancer, he was getting back into his own traditions, and he was really beginning to get back on track. He takes ill. He's ordered to go down to St. Paul's Hospital, a Catholic hospital in Vancouver. Within a day and a half, they have him on life support for undisclosed reasons, and then they pull the plug on him after not even diagnosing it. And I've checked with medical people, and you don't disconnect someone's life support system after, you know, 48 hours before even diagnosing it. So it's very suspect how he died. I can't speculate beyond that, because, what, you know, ultimately, what proof do you have? But it's not unusual for that to happen. And just like it wasn't unusual for Native children to be taken out of residential schools and trafficked, it was you know, that's being well documented. So it's part of what, you know, when you're implicating the powerful. I've had a lot of flack from that, actually, to say you shouldn't talk about that case because the Queen would interview that. I've been told.
Well, why would you know the British thought called David Duff? David Icke. Mm-hmm. So do you know that he talks about how the royal family are involved in paedophilia?
Yeah, he posted my stuff for a while in that case. Yeah. Oh, sorry, there's some there. Oh, okay, is that right?
I'm just wondering where you stand now on about, you know, Christian views.
About which?
Do you still have Christian views in fact?
No? I can't hear, I'm sorry.
Do you still have Christian
views? Christian views. I guess it depends on how you define Christianity. I mean, I was never, when I was in the church, I didn't really believe in big C Christianity. I was what you'd call it a low Christology, I think, where I saw Jesus as a teacher. And to me, the message was more what he was advocating rather than his person, being the Savior and all that. I don't identify with organized religion. I don't think I ever did, but especially now after what I've learned, even if, you know, somehow the United Church was forced to acknowledge all this stuff and they invited me back, I couldn't be part of that tradition anymore. You know, my own, it's kind of hard to talk about your own kind of spiritual direction. Just, and I'm always asked that question, so it's not like I'm evading it really. But it's just more, I guess you'd call me a humanist pagan or something like that. But I'm just finding the commonality is what counts. And in fact, I'm writing another book on, just a side note, a lot of the Bible is mistranslated. When you go back to the Old Testament, there's a very different story when you look at the original Hebrew and Greek that the church is deliberately, and I didn't learn any of this in seminary, and I thought I opened my lexicon in interlinear Bible and started to say, hey, that's not what it says. You know, there's a very different story, and something as simple as the term, I often use this example, reconciliation. When you look at the meaning of these words, a reconciliation in the medieval church was when you, during an inquisition, when somebody admitted that they had erred they were reconciled to the church by being imprisoned or losing their property or losing their life. That was called being reconciled. So, and it comes from a Roman tradition, well, as a lot of this stuff does, where when a rebel chieftain had fought against Rome and then was conquered, they brought him back to Rome. He reconciled himself to the emperor and then was ceremonially strangled in the forum. And that was seen as a way of reasserting imperial authority over somebody. So reconciliation doesn't mean, when they say there's a reconciliation process in Canada, what it really means is we are resubordinating Native people by this process, and that's exactly what's going on. They lose the right to sue, they're signing away the right to name the names. And the Canadian government's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is going all over presenting itself as this big, you know, attempt to look at the truth, you can't name names, you can't use any of this information in a lawsuit, you can't sue the churches, you're not granted immunity when you speak. It's all designed to tell Native people this, you know, back of the bus, boys, to stay where you're supposed to. And that comes out of that whole imperial Christian tradition, which is really a continuation of the Roman Empire, in my opinion. So there's something very different between that and the teachings of Jesus, something radically different. And so that's the one way of answering your question.
So one last one.
Yeah.
Just wonder where you're at with your ex-wife and your kids.
Eleanor, actually my youngest is 19, Claire is 22. They were both going to university. I never lost contact with them. Eleanor's over in London, actually, working this summer. And the thing about going through this trauma is, any trauma, you do your best not to share it with your kids. And I know this when I was in the healing circles with people, and I was trying to deal with this terrible losses in my own life. I mean, they could see that I had some understanding of what it meant to lose your kids. And you don't recover in the sense that, you know, you keep things, you keep the worst things from your children. So now they don't really understand what happened to me, and they're worried about kind of betraying their mom and feeling that they have to choose. And so, like a lot of Canadians, they don't want to have to make that choice. And so it's easier for them not to look at this stuff, and hence not to, like, there's a distance, and it's quite painful because my own family, after all this stuff happened, they just, you know, abandoned me. I feel like an alien in my own culture. I'm in this kind of gray zone. It's kind of an interesting process to go through, you know. But it's a long story. I mean, I found myself tongue-tied when I tried to talk to Claire and Eleanor about what really happened. Because they don't want to hear. To some degree, they don't want to hear. They don't want their world shaken up. On the other hand, they love me and they want to, so they're caught, you know. Sorry, and then you had to have a call.
I just wanted to say, is it the United Church that you were working for? I mean, what proportion do you think of that church are kind of complicit in all this? Is it from top to bottom, or?
Nuremberg has said complicity is just, you know, looking the other way.
Right.
At every level, it was complicit. The bus drivers, the people who brought the kids into the school, the coroners who faked the death records, the police. It involves so many levels of Canadian society that it's kind of like, you know, you're putting the whole culture on trial. And
it's just fear of losing their jobs, fear of, you know,
repercussions. We had a forum in Vancouver once, early on in this, and a white woman came and got up. And it was really amazing because she had the courage to come. She used to work at the Albury School, and she was sitting there with all the survivors. And she told a story of how she found a matron beating a little girl one day with a piano light, just killing her. So she grabbed the matron and whacked her to save the kid's life. Right? She's hauled before John Andrews, the principal. She's fired, not the woman beating the kid. Andrews said she plays the organ in church on Sunday, and whatever happened to that little squaw isn't a series of losing my organist. And so, okay, in that system, you know where the kids stand. Their lives don't matter. And if you want to keep your job, you go along. And it was a hierarchical system. And you know, people often say, well, how can death camps happen? Like, there was a really brilliant speech that the American prosecutor, Robert Jackson, chief American prosecutor, remember, he was speaking at a Jewish synagogue in the late 40s in New York, and he got up and he said, the SS were no different than you and I. He said that, by and large, people who run death camps are not psychopaths, they're bureaucrats. They are in a chain of command where you are doing your job and you go home at night, and these people are all churchgoers, and they went home, and just like in the residential schools, and they can live with themselves because they're one cog psychologically in the system, and that's why any level of society, you're talking about corporate reality there. I mean, that's the way we all live, frankly, in this society. So it's not unusual.
I'm just wondering, obviously you're putting a whole culture on trial, trying to. I'm just wondering where you get your strength from to deal with that, and also who are your allies in this battle?
Well, the people you see on the screen, people, unexpected people from all over. Groups that tend to be connected to the mainstream churches or the government in any way tend to avoid me with a 10-foot barge pole. I don't know where I got my strength from a lot of the time. I know that it's from my ancestors. I know that it's from within myself. I didn't know it was there. You know, I think when you go through these things, you find a strength that you don't know you have. One of the things, and I always do this, I've got a, when you see where it comes from, I had a ancestor called Peter Annett, and he was a humanist philosopher in the 1700s in London. And he wrote this book called The Free Inquirer. This is the only copy in the world. And he wrote it criticizing the Church of England and the Bible. He was like the, he was actually a contemporary of Voltaire and the American deists, you know, like the founding father, which is funny. Michael Moore makes the point that the founding fathers of America were not Christians. They were deists. They believed reason was God, that reason was that, like other people, free thinkers. So Peter was one, and he wrote this, he attacked the church and you know, for its hypocrisy, and he said, let's examine the Bible rationally. You know, could Moses have launched a rain of frogs on Pharaoh? Is that rational, you know? So anyway, the Attorney General in 1769, the Attorney General in London, seized all these, destroyed the printing press. Peter did a year's hard labor, and he was stuck in Charing Cross and at the Royal Exchange in the pillory when he was 70. And it's funny because when I first discovered this, I thought, shit, I'm the reincarnation of my ancestors. It's the same battle. I mean, when you think about it, it's the Church of England and the government. There's no separation between church and state. It's one gang, right? And I get my strength from that, from my ancestor. You know, the fact that he was able to stand up like that. And I get strength from the Sir Otters. I mean, if the horror they went through, they're still able to talk about them, minus nothing in comparison. So it's just being able to speak. Like, another example I want to give about that, William Coombs, who I mentioned before, who died in the hospital. He had been going to counseling for 15 years, and it was all bullshit. I mean, he didn't ever really get to the heart of what he was carrying, right, what he had witnessed in the body. So the only time I ever saw him get better prior to the period was before he died. We took this, there was 50 of us, and we walked into the main Catholic cathedral in Vancouver. And it was really neat that day because they knew we were coming, but we get there. It was Palm Sunday 2007. And there's no cops at the door, because usually there's a phalanx of Vancouver police protecting the church, right? And there were no police at the door, no security at the door, so we're just standing wide open. So I said, this is a sign, let's go. Right? So we go in with this banner, we go to the front of the sanctuary, stand in front of the communion table with the banner, and we're drumming, and the priests are like freaking right out, like they're saying, like, you've invaded our sanctuary here. But we're just standing there, part of the Mass, you know, to say, remember the children who died in your hands. And the congregation, it was funny because the congregation couldn't figure out what was going on, and so the priest kept getting the organist to keep playing the hymn over and over, so they're standing to try to drum us up, but we wouldn't go away, right? So finally, they're trying to get us out, we're not budging. And I look out and I see William. And before this, whenever William walked by the church and the church hall, he started getting physically sick. Because the image of the cross and those bells brought back all of that torture that he had suffered, and sodomization, all of that stuff at a young age, right? I look out and there's William walking up and down the pews, handing leaflets to people, right? And we come out of there and he stops drinking that week. Right? And I was talking to him later about that, and he said to me that when he got there, he was really scared, but then he saw all of us standing there, and he said he didn't want to let us down. He didn't want to be cowardly in front of all of us. So that got him to come a bit more. And then being in there, he got the strength from all of us, right? And that's the way you do it. You do it together. You do it publicly, and you give people a sense that they can do something. They're not a victim anymore. That they can confront this evil. They can name it, and that gives people what I would call some kind of recovery. I don't want to call it healing, but that's how I've seen it work. But we've got to do it together, and that's the strength we all have, right? Together. So that's where I get my strength.
This may be sensitive, but what about the big media players like BBC and Radio 4? Do they not want to touch you? Do you approach them? I mean, that's the solution.
You probably have a better sense of that than I do, what the media is like in this country, but no, they don't. There's been attempts like, I was at the protest, the Pope rally last September. I don't know if any of you made that. It was fantastic. It was like the humanist organized when Rat Boy, as they call him, came to London. £16 million was spent on this visit, something like that. And they expected a few hundred people to show up. They had 20,000. And it was like this fantastic celebration, right? It was just, but on that march, there's LBC in radio in London. A couple of them interviewed me, but it was kind of like the whole attitude is, oh, well, yeah, but we hear they've apologized. Canada's dealt with this, right? And they never take it further than that. They never look into the history. Well, you know, the 3-minute soundbite, 3-second soundbite mentality, you never have enough time, you know, to really go into the history. And they don't see the relevance. You know, it's in the past, it's like in the attitude that it doesn't, if it's 5 minutes before now, it has no meaning to the media. But on the other hand, there's groups all over this country that are on board. Like, I'm connected with Brian Garish, lawful rebellion people in Liverpool, who went into the court that day. I don't know if you know that story. Yeah. To me, it's very much this connected because, you know, the Crown and the state work together cause these crimes, and they're still responsible for a lot of these assaults on children. We're documenting child trafficking.
Very connected to the dumb driving case as well. Don't you know about that at all?
Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah.
Sorry, Kip. Yeah. You said you thought we knew the story. Can you just...
Which story?
Exactly. You just said...
The Birkenhead story.
Birkenhead. Somebody else who knows about
it. Yes, of course.
Yeah, it was basically annulling the authority of the Crown and federal courts and saying under common law you don't have a right to. I think it was that they were imposing this council tax. The people in the.
There was a judge.
The judge refused to confirm that he was acting on his own, as in he refused to confirm that he was being a proper judge. Because he did say if he admitted to being a proper judge, then the case would have collapsed. So he couldn't do that. And so 600 people got up and said, arrest that judge.
And they tried. They tried to arrest him, and then he got out at the last minute.
Yeah, he ran the police. They helped him. So they're now trying to take the judge and the police to court.
Right. So we're just giving an idea.
Common law, really said that to them, but something like that.
Quite a good idea.
Somebody else talked for a while.
Go on, then. My understanding of the rough common law is the only rules you really need to abide by. Is don't cause any harm, don't cause any loss, and do all you agreed to do, so contracts. So in the case of like council tax, Roger Hayes from UK Rebellion, the president saying, I conditionally accept to pay you the council tax upon production of a lawful contract, which there isn't.
And that goes for things like parking tickets and anything where we haven't contracted, we can basically refuse to.
Conditionally accept upon production of a lawful contract and signatures, which most of the time doesn't exist. You can get railroaded most of the time.
There must not exist in a scenario with these
places. No, I think it's about the state.
Yeah, although the common law argument is very interesting, I just wanted to ask you a bit more about the film. When did the boarding school kind of stop these practices, or did they carry on and stop, or did they close altogether? Have you encountered any kind of like whistleblowers or dissenting voices, or anyone that spoke up
about it, like from within, you know, the church or within the schools themselves?
Yeah, the last school being closed in 1996. A lot of them were phased out in the 70s and 80s. But just because they're phased out doesn't mean they don't continue. One sign of that is there are more Native children now in white foster homes than there were children in residential schools, and that's constantly increasing. There's a deculturalizing loss of language and family identity that happens. So in effect, residential schools were privatized. The intergenerational effects, the things that are passed on traumatically, that's constantly increasing, and none of the second, third generation survivors are included in any of the settlements or discussion at all. So it's like a lot of people suffering are just totally ignored by this. Whistleblowers in the church, well, there are, but they don't, I mean, there was one other minister who helped me in the United Church, and he faced the same thing, Bruce Gunn. And it's kind of like one of the difficulties I find approaching, and I don't want to generalize because there are people in the church who are trying to, they've actually been a good source of information for me about things that go on, but it tends to be a culture of silence, especially among the clergy, where you're under, it's understood that, and this was told to me in no uncertain terms, that you just don't do anything that's going to violate the harmony and unity of the church. That's seen as bottom line. And I know in the Canadian context, I don't know what it's like here, but causing disruption, being controversial, is the worst thing possible. Even more than the harming of children. That's been my practical experience. I know in theory it's different, but the practical reality is that you know, to do that is a sin. It's kind of like, in, there's a document you should know about called Crimen Solicitanus, which the present Pope actually helped write. And it's the policy of the Vatican towards when child abuse occurs in the Catholic Church. And the policy is to treat it, what they call it, it's called imposing the pontifical secret. So it's kind of like the bishop and the priest who's expected not to tell the police. Not to tell the police, that's a criminal act, and the child is harmed. If you do tell the police, you face excommunication, because it's to be solved within the church, because child abuse is a sin, not a crime. It's not a felony, it's a sin, as defined under that, which can be forgiven and dealt with within the church. That's, at least within the Catholic Church, the mentality. So today, the Pope is making a lot of noise about, we're going to hunt out pedophiles, we're going to get the heart of this. How can you, when you have that policy in place? It's a schizophrenic, you know, if you're, so if I'm a kind of a decent priest and I say, okay, well, I know about this case, but I'm going to get excommunicated according to this policy, but we're supposed to now, I mean, it's crazy, right? There's a case that happened just last month in Ottawa where this Archbishop Prendergast was hiding pedophile priests within his congregation, even a guy who had just come back from Thailand with child porn on his computer. And none of these guys can prosecute it. It's kind of like understood that under canon law, and there's a whole tradition here in England about that, and I found that out myself. I mean, canon law means within the church, you get to try your own. You get to deal with your own mess by yourself, and you're not subject to civil law. That's why a lot of this stuff can happen. I went to the BC Civil Liberties Association, I went to lawyers, they all said the same thing. Can't touch it, that's the church matter. I said, well, my human rights are being violated, they're destroying my life, you can't touch it? No, it's church matter. They can do what they want within their own courts. And that goes back to Henry II and Becket and all those guys. But the legacy we're dealing with from that is that allows these terrible crimes to go on. So one of the things that people talk about now is, you know, it's time to make the church accountable under civil law. Licensed priests, so that their license can be removed. There's public control over the church. They're not enclave, medieval enclaves where people can, if, you know, if you're a pedophile, you know, you can get ordained and get away with this shit. That 99% of the cases are never prosecuted. So, I mean, you need these bigger structural changes, I think, if you're serious about this. So that, and that brings me to one point I want to make. To be involved in this, there's lists up here you can sign. We're organizing, as part of the tribunal, local forums, so that people who have testimonies and documentation of this happening here, that can go into the record of the tribunal. We're working with a couple of legal groups in Europe that are bringing charges through the International Criminal Court against the Pope as a German citizen. They can't go after the Vatican because it's not a signatory to the ICC, but they can go after Ratzinger as a German citizen.
Is he still a German citizen?
Yes. And that, what that will do is it will legitimate you know, going out, and it's already happened in American courts. They've been trying to extradite the Pope to appear in American courts because Oregon judge ruled that people can now sue the Vatican for the harm they suffered. I work with people in Ireland, and when you sit and listen to their story, it's identical to Indian residential schools, including the death of children, the cover-up by the Garda, by the police. You know, it's the same policy right around the world. So this is why we're kind of letting people see it's not about an exotic group off in Canada somewhere. This is going to affect any of us, and is affecting us and our children. So, yeah, that's something I encourage you to be part of, and we can talk after. I think at 9:30 we'll break. We have till 10, but we can have more of a chance for informal talking about that. Yes.
You were mentioning about the Indians usually were favorited in schools by ones who told on the other children speaking their languages, how they moved into high positions.
Yeah, well, that's been a big problem because you see the kid, as Harriet mentioned in the film, if you collaborated, then you would get better treatment. You're in a protected group if you ratted out your fellow students. And those kids, and we know because we documented this, and these people are well known, the ones who got to go on to university and get an education were the ones who were often in that role as kids. So when we began to first tell these stories, the tribal council chiefs, now there's two systems of power in the Native world. There's the government-appointed system of government-funded tribal council, chief and council, they're called. And there's a parallel system of the traditional elders, the hereditary chiefs, the clan mothers. Like in many of the Native nations in Canada, like in the Mohawk Confederacy on the West Coast, you had clan mothers who were appointed the chiefs. There were chiefs is a European term. There wasn't that kind of fixed authority in most of the nations. But the clan mothers, being the grandmothers, would know the children in the villages, and they could demote or promote people as chiefs. Well, Indian affairs got rid of all of that, but those clan mothers are still around. And it's the government-funded chiefs. They go in, they identify the people, collaborate, and these are the guys who often work most strongly against this stuff coming out. There's a group, you know, I don't know if you, the Assembly of First Nations in Canada, 630 chiefs who are elected by their friends on the reserve, and then they appoint the head chief among themselves. You know, it's like the mayors of this country getting together and appointing the prime minister and calling that democracy. I mean, that Native people don't run those organizations, but they're government arms. So they can administer, you know, like classic what they do is they sign treaties. A lot of the people on the streets of Vancouver are there because they've been forced off their land, because their chiefs have signed deals with hydroelectric companies and others, forced them off their land, and they're refugees in their own country, and the chiefs benefit a lot. You know, the first time I went to get, I tried to get the tribal council in Port Alberni to help fund their food bank, because most of the people in the food bank were Native. The chief had five cars in his driveway. He said, well, I made it out of there, why can't they? You know, it's kind of total disdain for his own people. I'm not saying all chiefs are like that, but you get that kind of deliberate divide and conquer, and I'm not even blaming them as individuals, because that's what a system of neo-colonialism does. It knows how to divide and conquer, and the British were adept at that historically. Did it in Africa, did it all over the world, and it's still in place in a big way. And so, until you change that, I'll see you later. Until you change that, nothing's going to change. And the way it's changing is among younger Native people who aren't identified with that old system. And that's actually a lot of people who support our campaign are that, a younger, kind of in a nutshell, that's kind of difficult.
I just want to ask you how you feel about 2012, Kevin.
Well, you know, in a nutshell, I think that it's hard to understand what another culture means by their prophecies. 2012, I mean, when I studied a little bit of Mesoamerican anthropology, my reading of the Mayan prophecies were, it's not our Cartesian linear view of history, it's a cyclical view. So the end of a cycle doesn't necessarily mean cataclysm or disaster. It simply means an ending and the start of something different. I definitely think we're heading for a showdown, ecologically and in many ways, spiritually. I think there's some really bad things coming down the pipe. Whether it happens in December 2012, I don't know. I'm unclear about that personally. I know a lot of people in the native world believe it. I know they believe there's other prophecies, though, and those aren't the only ones. But what you, I mean, Lillian Shirt, who was in the film, she's the great-granddaughter of Wandering Spirit, who, and I don't know if you know Canadian history, but there was a real rebellion. The Métis people rebelled in the 1880s, and one of their spiritual leaders was Wandering Spirit, and he made the prediction. He saw the residential schools in the Indian Act coming, and he said there'd be a time in the future, and it was kind of similar to the Hopi prophecy, where he said, when the pale ones are gone by the great wave, that the people will survive by going to the highest mountaintop. And so Lillian was always taught as a kid to always keep rope with her. And she didn't know why her grandmother was saying, keep rope, you know. But it's their prophecy that flee to the mountains because there's a disaster coming. So when and how, I don't know. But these are common things you hear in the native world. Just like you hear in the, among the West Coast people, their experience of Christ. They said that this woman came before the whites, warning her people about the coming of the pale ones, who would be imposters, who would have the form of her teachings, but not the substance, which is respect and equality and love, unconditional love. And what I find interesting, I used to joke with the Catholic priest and I would put a burning, I said, well, if you guys believe in the virgin birth, the offspring had to be female, because you got an egg and there's no sperm involved. So if you believe in the virgin birth, Jesus had to be a woman. And you got that kind of full tradition in the native world. This is biology, right? So, that whole tradition in the native world where the Christ came to them as a woman, and they knew about it. When the missionaries arrived, that's why they welcomed the missionaries, because they already knew this stuff. And I think that's amazingly significant, because the whole basis of the European laws which gave the land to the Europeans was that they don't know Christianity. This is priceless. In the 12th century, the only Englishman ever to be the Pope, Adrian IV, he's put in there by Henry II, who's about to invade Ireland. Adrian brings in a papal law called laudabilitum, which means in Latin, it is laudable. It's a good thing to do. And it authorizes the English conquest of Ireland. And they use the same rationale they then used later in North America with Native people. They said, the Irish are deficient in the true religion, Roman Catholicism. Therefore, in exchange for receiving the true religion and civilization, the Irish will give us their land. That was the deal. They didn't consult any Irish, any of my people, but they did exactly the same thing. The Pope said, to civilize these people, they will then give us the land. That's the trade-off. And they should be thankful to us. And that was the mentality, and that's still in place. So, I don't know what the question was, but I can't remember. Don't ever... The Pope's a preacher in your life. But that's what we're dealing with, that kind of mentality. I don't think it's ever changed. I mean, it's just being secularized. We do that in Afghanistan and Iraq with the same arrogance, you know, but it's the same culture. Yeah.
In all the individual journeys you've seen, what part has forgiveness played to the perpetrators and in any healing?
That's a good question. I haven't seen many cases of that. We tried that at first. We invited
no perpetrators. I'm kind of really interested when people do experience some trauma. Obviously, the psychological terrain they've got covered is so much greater. And I just wonder, what are the blocks? What are the things that can help traverse that terrain? And I'm thinking forgiveness is probably.
Do you mean forgiveness on the part of the people being victimized?
Well, I've always had a bit of struggle over what actually forgiveness is. Is it forgiveness for yourself so that you can move on, or is it a deep level of forgiveness where you can say, you know, hand on high, forgive you for, you know what you do, sort of thing?
It's funny looking at, I've looked into this a lot actually, because it was a big issue in the healing circles. Some people say, to hell with them, I don't have to forgive. Others say, I have to in order to move on, right? But if you look at the words used in Aramaic that Jesus used, the term he used, I forget it offhand, but Aramaic is rusty, but the term I remember when he's talking about forgiveness in Hebrew and Aramaic, it meant to do this. Turn 180 degrees around and walk away. So that isn't addressing the perpetrator, that's addressing us. Say, don't have anything to do with that anymore, just walk away. And that's how you recover, right? And if recovery is possible. But then I always say, well, what about what's going to happen to the next person when you do that, right? And the hands, how do you stop the perpetrator? Does forgiveness do it? It happens sometimes. Like, I worked in prison ministry, and I've seen cases of people who genuinely change, but most of the time that happens because they've been caught. And I don't know, so I go back and forth on this. Like, sometimes I think it's because of that threat that people are forced to look at something. Like, the only reason the churches began to issue apologies is to face lawsuits. None of the apologies happened before they were hit with lawsuits. So if there was a genuine desire on the part of those institutions to change, we would have seen it long before that. Because they knew what they did. They knew very well what they did. But there's a different ethos and spirit around an institution than an individual. Like, you can talk to an individual official in that organization and agree with you, but there's this overarching, whatever you want to call it, group mind. They call it the angel in the New Testament. Whenever Paul is writing to the churches, he doesn't write to the members of the church, he writes to his angel, the kind of overarching spirit, the corporate mind, if you like. That corporate mind doesn't allow itself to dissolve. It says the institution is the ultimate measure, and you have to protect that. And people within it are used to doing that. So they've given up the right of individual conscience in return for that security. And so it's hard to get through to people like that to say, no, you have to acknowledge these things, right, for it to change. So I don't know what other people think. It's a big question. Like, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah?
He used the word inoculation. In conjunction with missionaries being a small pox. So are you saying that people are actually injected as well with small pox?
Well, that's what's been alleged. It's in the guy who, just in a case that I referred to, John Sheepshanks, the guy who researched this is a librarian up in Cornell, British Columbia. He found all the original newspaper articles and some of the government documents about it. And apparently what he was, the reference, and you can read this, it's actually up online, this whole thing, hiddennolonger.com, you can download the book. The reason I had to put it online is these books were all disappearing from Canadian libraries, so we put it up on the, thank you, we put it up on the site hiddennolonger.com, so you can read it there, it's in the appendix about what they did exactly. I believe they were injecting smallpox.
Because I used to read the encounters between the Europeans and the natives. Yeah. The Europeans would give them blankets in exchange for various services. And so your story makes a difference.
Well, it was blankets as well. In the case of Amherst, General Amherst, he kept a record about it. The Amherst Diary is now published by the Mi'kmaq people in Nova Scotia. And you can read in detail, he described to his major bouquet, his subordinate, how they were going to do this. But here he is, John Sheepshanks, 1834 to 1909. And you can read about, his own hand, him describing him doing this. So I don't think it's inconceivable. Here's a quote from Hudson's Bay Company trader John McLean, 1908. He wrote a book about it later. I just got a blanket well infected with smallpox. Carefully put it between a saddle blanket and a sweat pad. I succeeded. They all died of smallpox. He kept a journal about it.
Right.
Anyway, that's all I hear. He hasn't spoken yet, is that right?
We've seen so many victims of violence and use and torture. Have you come across recently with the perpetrators of these acts?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, are there in the movie coming up?
Are there perpetrators in the film? No. Not in the film. No. But I had a couple of times where people came to me and they didn't want. There was a case of a man who had worked in an Anglican school, lived in British Columbia, St. George's Residential School, and he came to me with the agreement that I would never name his name. And he described the manacles and the pillories that they put the kids in after they ran away. And he described sodomizing children. He described whipping them so that they died.
How did they feel about me?
He was a haunted man. He looked like he was dead. He looked like he was dead inside. He had to tell somebody, but he was old. He was in his 80s. And, yeah.
So he wasn't repentant of what he did?
I can't.
He wasn't disturbed by it.
Yeah, he was haunted. Absolutely, he was. Anyway, would be, except unless you're totally dissociated, which I think you have to. That's what I find, like, in this culture, it's like, you've got to be dissociated. Somebody said to me after I was fired as a minister, your problem, Kev, is that you weren't dissociated enough as a clergyman, is you expected people to live this, you expected the church to live it, and it's that's not the way I found with when I got up in presbytery meetings and tried to talk about this. It's like every minister in the room, they knew that it was time to back off, like it had nothing to do with this. I was alone on this. And there are clergy who have tried the same thing and faced the same consequence, but you don't hear about it because it's a shame thing. You know, you're there's a lot of guilt that goes on. And there's a whole other issue about trying to get. I think if the clergy came forward and confronted this more, there'd be a lot more changes because they know the history. You know, some of these older guys.
Was Alfred Caldwell dead by the time?
Yeah. Caldwell died in the 60s.
Who's that?
Alfred Caldwell killed Maisie Shaw. There was a witness. He was the principal of the United Church Ministry.
Oh, right.
His daughter was in my congregation, Joan Jacobson, and she saw that as soon as I started talking about this, she'd get up and walk out of the church. She knew it was all true, right? But I wasn't supposed to talk about it. Sorry, there's something about it. Well, I mean, it's kind of like we don't want to know. It's kind of like when you talk to people, and when I speak in Germany, I ask them the same question to see how they respond. And, you know, it's kind of like the attitude among the old. I was speaking to one young German who lives near Munich, where Dachau was, and they said, well, they all knew, but they think, what can we do about it, first of all?
That's taught in schools. I was taught about Holocaust and in schools.
Because they lost the war. Germany lost the war. We didn't lose our war. We won our war. That's the difference, I think. So, that's...
If the Germans had won, they'd be in schools, they'd be teaching all about it, of course they
would. Yeah, they'd, and Churchill would be one.
We would have been genocide over it.
Yeah, but it's morally, I don't understand. Like, I still, after years of this stuff, in here, I will never understand. It's not like I can understand this stuff.
There's an author called, I don't know if you know him, he's an Australian author called Greg Hallett.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a sort of thesis, it's David Icke also shares this idea, which is that the British royal family put people in positions of power, judges, ministers, government ministers and so on, who are often involved in organised paedophilia and other such crimes, in order to make these people obedient and pliable.
Yeah.
So perhaps this is why this phenomenon exists in the first place, because it does make you wonder about human nature, priests doing that to children. And I think perhaps it's got something to do with
it. Well, it's not like that stuff doesn't go on, but I think a more relevant way to look at it is the fact that all of us go through a European tradition of childbearing, coming out of the doctrine of the fall, that every child born is cursed, that the earth is cursed, and that any amount of force is necessary to make the child compliant. You don't trust the natural wisdom and understandings of children, which, and in the indigenous world, even after all this genocide, they still revere children as a source of knowledge, not as something to be controlled and made into something. And that there's an excellent book called by Alice Miller called For Your Own Good. And it looks at the roots of violence in European child rearing methods. And the basic thesis is that we're all traumatized the way we're raised because we're not trusted, ultimately, as children. And we learn to suppress our first impulses, our first things are our judgment. And so you look at anybody in a room, and we have this built-in fear of authority. Like, I've done something wrong. Like, the classic case I was telling people earlier is these people I knew in Vancouver for years, they were like very militant political radicals and everything. We're going to go pick up a Catholic church. And the first thing this guy said is, are we allowed to do that? Like, it's a church after all, are we allowed? And so I'm, you know, I'm like, where the hell does that stuff come from except by the way you were raised? And that's the harder thing to break. I mean, it's easy to say those guys are, you know, lizards from the Pleiades and they rape children, and you compartmentalize the issue and you don't take responsibility for it. My fundamental question is, why do we all commentize? I mean, why do we, you know, call a meeting in Vancouver and 10 people show up about this stuff? This stuff is fundamental. This is about children, for God's sake, right? And how it's still happening. I think the hall would be filled, but people instinctively pull back from child abuse because you're looking at your own shit, right? And Alice Miller says, if you become, what's the church uses? You become insensitive to your own,
desensitive
to your own trauma, you cannot be sensitive to injustice in the world. You cannot, and you stand by and let it happen because you have no empathy for yourself. So how can you have empathy for your neighbor or somebody anywhere, right? So like learning empathy for yourself, looking at doing our own work is really essential in this. I found this work in the healing circles. First thing the native person said was, we don't want to tell our story, we want to hear your story. We want to see if you're struggling with this stuff. Where's the healing circle for white people? You know, this is what I've been trying to do now. I've been trying to say to members of parliament and church leaders, you better sit down here, we've got to talk about how we did this. What is it from our culture that's doing this? Because we're doing it, we're still doing it. Look at the way we're treating native people. You hand them a bit of money, you sign off, they go kill themselves in frustration, and we call that healing? You know, it's like, how can we do that? So that's the job is not for us to take that responsibility and not think we can bring justice or healing to anybody if we don't start with ourselves. So that's a big job, but a necessary one. I think it has to do with our survival. End of sermon.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I remember when you spoke once, you said that the native people back home, when you see them and talk to them about when you come to Europe, they're always really excited to hear your stories, and that they it's almost part of their healing process, that they know the people in this country or the countries that you go to are willing to listen and to take time out like this and come out in the evening to hear Kevin speak. So just by being here, you're part of their healing process.
Absolutely. I can't tell you how important it is to people. I mean, last time I was in Brighton, we had about, what, 10 people in the pub?
Yeah.
And now, I mean, every time I come back, and this is not unusual, every time I come back the second time, the crowds are a lot bigger. Because there's this awakening happening, I mean, people know. And when I go back in Vancouver and I just tell people what's happened, they are just so, it's like this amazing weight off their shoulders because they're not alone anymore, because as a victim, and I know, in the course of this work I had to deal with my own abuse issues, that I had buried completely when I was 2 years old in a 6-year-old's hospital in Toronto. I had been molested by nurses there. And I didn't, you know what, came to me one day in healing circle, and I completely fell apart. And it was the native people there that helped me, because they knew how to do it. Because they said, the way they say whites don't know how to process grief, because they don't realize that it has to do with just returning to the things that give us life, you know, the earth and one another, right? And we do it for generations. Like, they have this long-term view of how you change, right? So when I had to deal with that own, my own abuse issue, I realized that the hardest thing as a victim is to be believed, right? You've got to be believed and taken seriously, and nobody wants to believe you, right? Because it might implicate Uncle Fred, or the local cop, or whoever. So to be believed, and to know there's people saying, I believe you, and we want to share your story. And it's, when I tell them that I'm repentant, it's being duplicated, because I don't copyright anything, it's being duplicated and get it out. And when they know that 500,000 people have seen that film, it's like, I get emails all the time from, like, a native woman in Northern Alberta writes to me and says, I was going to kill myself, and then I saw your film, and I think, thank God, now the world knows, you know? I just to know that the world knows and I'm being believed, you know, it's life-giving. And I, That's true about any of us, I think. So I just can't ask. Overestimate, underestimate, I'm tired. What the importance of you just taking this information and sharing it, and who was it who said that if you do something once, it doesn't mean anything, but if you do it over and over and over, it has an impact. Well, I mean, look at my case. Like, I'm just one guy working on this, and in 15 years, I just kind of let go. And the impact it's had, now you multiply that by a few thousand times, there's nothing we can achieve. I believe that. I've seen that on the ground. I mean, the people I work with have nothing. You know, they're homeless. Like, they are, every moment is a struggle to survive. And yet, they have the courage, you know.
Maybe it's just because they've got nothing to lose when they've got so much courage.
That's right. But that's easier said than done. I mean, it's still, when you go up, I mean, we've had people killed. I mean, like, Bingo Dawson, my friend, was killed by 3 Vancouver cops, December 2009. You probably read that on my website, because he was speaking out about what they were doing to people on the street. They just caught him in an alley and killed him. And the death record said alcohol withdrawal, you know, the usual nonsense. But, I mean, people die from this. If I was Native, I'd be dead by now.
Right.
So I used my white skin to an advantage, right? But it's really amazing and beautiful to see this on the ground happen. And I just, anyway, yeah.
How do you get funding for like traveling and everything? And that's a messy answer.
Glad you raised that.
What's happening in London and when?
Oh, yeah. I work with the Holly Green Network and people looking at state-level child trafficking. June 4th, 1 p.m., Trafalgar Square, there's a national child abuse rally. And there's going to be a group that they're going to be those guys who did the acrobatic protest, the banner for Big Ben. Who was that?
Father's Justice.
They're going to be there. Don't tell me about it. We're going to, right in Trafalgar Square, you got Canada House right there. So it's perfect. And it's right across, I don't know if you know, it's the South African Embassy in Canada. They kind of mirror each other. I thought that was appropriate. But it's right there. And so if you all want to come up with that, that'd be great. And I'm also, I'll be here all during the summer and fall working. So there's the contact sheet. And here's my contact.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.